Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the August 14, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows an urban street corner. The background, the buildings in the street are kind of whited out. In the foreground, there is a postal service mailbox, like you'd drop off a letter on the street corner. In front of it is a young African-American woman. She's got khakis and a polo shirt, face mask on. She's looking confused. She's got in her hands a card that says official ballot enclosed, but the post office box is taped over. It's got duct tape over the place where you would put a letter in, and it's got two little signs attached to it. One of them says, election postponed, your president, and the other one says, totally rigged. The title is Election Chaos, Trump's plan to challenge the legitimacy of mail-in ballots. And I believe we picked that up on the controversy of the week, but we'll start, as always, with the main stories and how they were covered. Benefits lapse amid a record economic collapse. What happened? Congressional Republicans, White House officials, and Democrats struggled this week to come to terms on a coronavirus relief bill. As the U.S. economy reeled from the biggest contraction on record, and federal jobless benefits lapsed for nearly 30 million Americans. In meetings between White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer, the two sides traded specific proposals, with Republicans making concessions. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he'd support a bill that included an extension of the $600 a week unemployment benefits, a key point of contention that many in his party oppose. We're making progress, Schumer told reporters. Both he and McConnell said they were hopeful the basic outlines of a deal could be reached this week and voted on next week, but much remained unresolved. Democrats essentially want to renew the $3.4 trillion relief bill the House passed in May, while Senate Republicans are offering $1 trillion with a $200 instead of a $600 supplement to unemployment benefits. Democrats want to include billions in aid for cities and states, the Postal Service, food assistance, child care, and election security, while Republicans want a more narrowly focused aid package. The biggest sticking point has been the jobless benefits, which expired last Friday. Democrats are calling for another 6 months of $600 payments, a non-starter for some Republicans who contend that the payments discourage some recipients from going back to work. Second quarter GDP numbers revealed an unprecedented 9.5% contraction, or an annual rate of 33%. As retailers, restaurants, and other businesses closed their doors. Real people are sitting back home and wondering why all the kabuki games. Why can't we just do it? Said Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida. President Trump, who is not directly participating in the negotiations, repeatedly threatened to issue an executive order to extend jobless benefits and an eviction moratorium if there's no deal. I'll do it myself if I have to, said Trump, though whether he has that power is unclear. What the editorial said. Congress has effectively pushed millions of jobless Americans off a cliff, said the New York Times. For many, the $600 unemployment supplements that lapsed last week are all that has kept them from going hungry and allowed them to stay in their homes. Yet Republicans stalled for months on a new aid package, only to offer people who can't pay rent or buy food anemic help. The $600 enhancement to unemployment benefits is slowing the recovery, said the Wall Street Journal. If people make more money by not working, fewer people will work. The evidence is clear. In Ohio, where jobless workers can pull $9.40 a week, Honda has had so much trouble staffing an assembly line, it's reassigned office workers. In Kentucky, where the lowest paid quarter of unemployment workers are now on average receiving checks for more than double their normal pay, labor force participation has dropped 4.8 points since February. What the columnist said. The notion that people aren't returning to work because of added unemployment benefits is a myth, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. Five separate studies, including ones by researchers at Yale University and the University of Chicago, have all concluded the same thing. The $600 federal supplement does not appear to have depressed job growth and provides needed relief and stimulus. The reality is that people can't go back to work because there is very little work for them to do, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. The jobless benefits are actually sustaining the economy by putting money into the pockets of people who spend it. Without them, millions more jobs will be lost. The Republicans' disconnect from reality on jobless benefits has a long history, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. For years, they've sold the notion that the jobless are moral failures who would rather sit home watching TV than work. During the Trump years, they've unleashed a relentless assault on programs that help the less fortunate, from Obamacare to food stamps. How many of these deficit hawks took issue with Trump's $2 trillion tax cut for corporations and the wealthy? It's actually Nancy Pelosi who's betraying struggling Americans, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Rather than strike a reasonable compromise on benefits or even pass a temporary extension, she refused to budge, hoping to embarrass Republicans into caving in. If Republicans capitulate, Democrats win, because they'll get credit for the cash windfall, even as it slows a recovery that would benefit Trump's reelection. If the Republicans refuse to cave and there's no deal, Democrats also win, as the recovery craters and Republicans get the blame. For Pelosi, defeating Trump is the only thing that matters, regardless of how much pain it causes working Americans. And now to our controversy of the week. Trump, is he tampering with the election in advance? As polls show him badly trailing with Election Day less than 90 days away, a desperate President Trump has reached for one of the last tricks in the dictator's handbook, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times. Repeating his baseless claim that widespread mail-in voting amid the pandemic would lead to the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history, Trump tweeted last week, delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. The authoritarian tone was chilling, but Trump has no power to postpone the election. The date of every presidential election was set by Congress in 1845. And only Congress could change it. Pushback from Republican senators like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham make it likely Trump will drop his unconstitutional suggestion, said Amanda Carpenter in TheBulwark.com. But not before it has served his purpose. by spreading rumors and lies about the supposed evils of mail-in voting, he's laying the groundwork to challenge the results of the election. Trump, in fact, has revealed he hopes to steal the election, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. By demonizing mail-in voting among Republicans, Trump is making it chillingly plausible that he could hold a narrow lead on election night with millions of Democratic votes tied up in slower-to-count mail-in ballots. If so, Trump can simply declare victory and dismiss the uncounted backlog as the massive fraud he warned about. Worse, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com, ballots not received by Election Day are automatically rejected under current law in 33 states. This presumably explains why Trump appointed Louis DeJoy, a loyal mega donor, to be Postmaster General in May, and why DeJoy's first act was a peculiar cost-cutting initiative that has already slowed national mail delivery to a crawl. Slow delivery is just one of a cavalcade of problems with voting by mail, said Scott Hoganson in the Wall Street Journal. In the three states where the practice is universal, ballot applications are simply blasted out to every name on the voter rolls, with no way to tell how many are mailed to dead people or forwarded to people who have moved to other states. Especially during a pandemic, it's a recipe for chaos. Hysterical liberals are convinced Trump will refuse to leave office if he loses, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. But even if he and his supporters insist that he was robbed, the Constitution states that his term in office ends at noon on January 20th, 2021. The next president is whomever Congress has certified as the winner of November's election. Anyone who thinks Trump will let laws or the Constitution stop him has not been paying attention, said David Rothkopf in USA Today. Neither laws nor the Constitution kept Trump from using taxpayer and foreign dollars to enrich himself in office, or from blackmailing foreign allies to manufacturing dirt on his political opponents. He's going to try to suppress and invalidate mail-in votes, and if he loses, he will refuse to concede defeat. Let him try, said Matt Bai in the Washington Post. The most fitting way for this dystopian chapter in the U.S. history to end is with Trump being escorted from the White House by military police. Our democratic institutions have been stretched to their limits by this lawless president, but how cathartic for a nation to watch Trump find out the hard way that, despite his best efforts, they aren't broken. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for Newspeak. After CNN reported that, quote, individuals with a cervix, unquote, are being urged to get tested for cervical cancer. After days of online mockery, CNN Vice President Matt Dornick tweeted, I'm sorry it's so upsetting for some of you to acknowledge the existence of transgender men and women. It was a good week for novel excuses. After an elderly Florida man arrested for drunk driving a golf cart blamed his intoxication on watching President Trump give a coronavirus briefing. Kerry DeVan, 82, told officers he got really mad at what Trump said and started drinking vodka. It was a good week for dirty tricks. After four people active in Republican politics sought to get Kanye West on the presidential ballot in several states, including swing state Wisconsin, West's wife, Kim Kardashian, has recently described West as mentally ill. But it was a bad week for hands touching hands reaching out. After Murphy's Irish Pub in Coralejo, Spain, removed Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline from its music menu because patrons can't resist singing along, indoor group singing is known to spread the coronavirus. It was a bad week for overdosing after a light plane bound for Australia, stuffed with 1,100 pounds of cocaine, crashed during takeoff from an airport in Papua New Guinea. Police said the weight of the illegal cargo may have had an impact on the plane's ability to take off. Finally, it was a bad week for money laundering after a South Korea bank only partially reimbursed a man who ran cash through his washing machine to rid it of coronavirus. The Bank of Korea said it could pay the man only half value for 507 50,000 won notes, each originally worth $42. And before we leave the page, a short newsy note. Shorter deadline for final census count. The U.S. Census Bureau announced this week that it will halt all counting efforts for the 2020 census on September 30th, a month sooner than planned, drawing fierce objections from civil rights groups and Democrats who say the Trump administration is trying to deliberately undercount poor people and immigrants. The decision gives census workers just 6 weeks to track down 37% of American households that have yet to respond. Four former directors of the Census Bureau issued a statement warning that the accelerated deadline would result in seriously incomplete enumerations in many areas across our country. The House has approved a five-month counting extension because of the pandemic, but the Senate has not approved or even scheduled a vote on a new timeline. The title of our briefing page article is QAnon Goes Mainstream. GOP candidates and Trump supporters are pledging allegiance to a nonsensical conspiracy theory. What is QAnon? It's a conspiracy theory claiming that world leaders, Democrats, and deep state U.S. intelligence officers are all involved in a global child sex trafficking ring that President Trump and his supporters are working to expose and destroy. Named for Q, a supposed military official who began posting anonymously on fringe message boards in 2017, QAnon promises a great awakening for patriots who get a steady diet of breadcrumbs on the internet, clues revealing aspects of this global plot. Thousands of Americans have enlisted as believers in QAnon, which the FBI calls a domestic terror threat. Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who initially pleaded guilty to lying about his contacts with Russia, took the Q oath on a YouTube video on July 4th, ending by reciting the slogan, "Where we go one, we go all." Trump's son Eric posted the same slogan on Instagram this summer. Before the pandemic ended Trump's rallies, attendees had begun displaying Q on clothing and paraphernalia and calling themselves Trump's soldiers on the ground. At least 11 GOP candidates for Congress this year openly support QAnon. Like who? Joe Ray Perkins, the Oregon Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. During her May victory speech, Perkins said, "I stand with Q and the team. Thank you, QAnons. Together we can save our republic." This year, 59 Senate and congressional candidates expressed some form of Q support and amassed nearly 600,000 votes, the Washington Post reports. While most nominees like Perkins are likely to get trounced in November, at least two are expected to win House seats. Lauren Boebert, who defeated incumbent Scott Tipton in the Colorado primary, has said, I hope Q is real. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the front runner in a GOP runoff in Georgia this month, calls QAnon a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take this global cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles out. She's gotten endorsements from Trump and Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. How did QAnon start? On October 28, 2017, a new user calling himself Q posted on 4chan, a right-wing site favored by white supremacists. Q was a reference to the clearance level for top-secret material, such as nuclear weapons designs. Q predicted the imminent arrest of Hillary Clinton and used conspiratorial cliches like follow the money. His prophecies grew out of Pizzagate, the debunked theory that Clinton was running a child sex dungeon out of a popular Washington, D.C. pizzeria. In 2016, a North Carolina man armed with two loaded guns and a knife went to the pizza place to free the children, only to discover there was no basement, no kids. Q has since posted hundreds of times on 4chan, 8chan, and 8kun, using a password-protected identifier to thwart imitators. What are his beliefs? Q prophesies an upcoming event called The Storm, when Trump will send thousands of traitorous elites to Guantanamo Bay. One absurd theory claims John F. Kennedy Jr. faked his fatal plane crash in 1999 and could emerge this year as Trump's running mate. Believers have been inspired to plot kidnapping raids, and one follower, Anthony Comello of New York City, says Q inspired him to murder mafia boss Francesco Cali. Q's apocalyptic writings increasingly echo evangelical Christian beliefs about end times, with Trump described as a messiah-like figure. I feel like God led me to Q, said Laurie Schock, 57, of Ohio, who has spent up to 6 hours a day researching the theory. How many followers are there? It's impossible to say for sure, but social media indicates Q is exploding into the mainstream. Twitter recently banned 7,000 accounts that posted QAnon material, and Facebook is reportedly planning a similar crackdown on its 175-plus QAnon groups with a combined 1.4 million members. Q indoctrinator David Hayes has 377,000 Twitter followers, and his YouTube videos explaining the basic tenets have 33 million views. Candidates are eager to tap into this audience, even if they think QAnon is a bunch of crap, said Sam Williams, a Republican who lost a House runoff election in Texas last month after retweeting Q hashtags and slogans. I did that to gain followers, Williams said. Can't Q be debunked? A mountain of evidence against QAnon has piled up, but it seems to have made no difference. Hillary Clinton, for example, has not been arrested. Believers find affirmation in events like the arrest of financier Jeffrey Epstein on child sex trafficking charges. They're like flat earth adherents, said Alice Marwick, a University of North Carolina researcher, who have a different way to interpret the world, which colors everything they see. For those who view Q as a religion, their beliefs, by definition, can't be falsified, while their deity continues to send signs to reinforce their faith. He talks to us in codes, a woman named Diane told Vanity Fair last November after a Trump rally in Sunrise, Florida. It's all about God, all about spiritual warfare. Trump will tell you that over and over. Is Trump Q? Some QAnon followers believe Trump himself is Q, the leader posting cryptic prophecies on message boards. Weeks before Q's first post in 2017, Trump stood for a photo with military leaders at the White House and asked reporters, You guys know what this represents? He proceeded to trace an incomplete circle in the air with his index finger, the letter Q, supposedly, and said, "Maybe it's the calm before the storm." Followers believe Trump's randomly capitalized tweets contain secret messages, as when he tweeted, quote, "I am giving consideration to quarantine," end quote, in March, and a day later tweeted, quote, "I am a great friend and admirer of the Queen," end quote. Delete most letters in both tweets. Read, quote, "I am dot, 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 Q," end quote. One thing is certain. Trump has retweeted dozens of QAnon hashtags and released a campaign video last year that showed two supporters holding signs marked with Qs. In March, Trump retweeted a meme of him playing the violin, captioned with the QAnon slogan, "Nothing can stop what is coming." Trump added, "Who knows what this means, but it sounds good to me." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with one from the U.S. titled, "When Women Are Too Ambitious." As a possible one-term president who's pledged to pick a woman as his running mate and his possible successor, Joe Biden offered hope he could play an instrumental role in breaking the highest glass ceiling, said Pima Levy. But with the vice presidential selection finally around the corner, the conversation no longer sounds anything like progress. Some Democrats are reportedly resisting the possible selection of Senator Kamala Harris because of her ambition. Harris, one of the many Democrats who ran against Biden in the primaries, has strong credentials as a senator and former California Attorney General. She's a self-confident woman of color who could step into the presidency, meeting two of Biden's most important criteria. But her criticism in two debates of Biden's history of opposing school busing has Biden's aides worried she might not be a loyal, deferential number two. In other words, they want a woman, just not that kind of woman. It's a stinging reminder of what's been the biggest barrier to putting a woman in the White House. The absurd belief that women who are driven enough to rise to the top tier of American politics should not be too ambitious. This comes from Sweden. Amazon threatens our workers. Sweden is about to be invaded by a hulking behemoth intent on destroying our economy, said Lotta Ilona Harjen. Amazon is so big and so rich that it is more reasonable to compare it to a privatized state than to call it a firm. If the e-commerce colossus opens a Swedish site in the fall as planned, it could fundamentally change our labor market for the worse. Amazon's business model is based on creating a monopoly, routing all online sales through its platform. Swedish department stores and online stores risk being frozen out. If you're not selling through Amazon, you don't exist. And if you do sell there, you will be squeezed by its constant price pressure. Yet the low prices that bring consumers flocking to the site are guaranteed through harsh conditions and low wages for the company's warehouse workers. At Amazon's fulfillment centers, every step is clocked and measured. Workers are constantly on the run and can't even take a break to go to the bathroom without being penalized. Workplace injuries and accidents are common. The Swedish economic model has worked so well because it is based on a balance of employers' and workers' interests. Amazon will try to squash that system, and the entire Swedish labor market must prepare to fight back. This column comes from Uganda, where English is the language of corruption. English has become a dirty word in today's Uganda, said Joaquin Buwembo. If someone says, in English no less, that a person or action has a lot of English, they mean it's a con. How does this happen in a land where 85% of the population is fluent in the Queen's language? Blame white-collar crime, grand corruption, deceit, and senseless looting. Families have lost ancestral land because corrupt lawyers drew up manipulative deeds in English. Corruption that dumps public money into the pockets of the elite is committed with documents drafted by evil minds in English. One con man skilled at a fake British accent actually amassed his wealth by renting out his voice to other swindlers who would put him on the phone to convince their marks that they had a legitimate investor they were representing. That's why when you hear someone in Kampala say, there is a lot of English in this deal, you can be sure they have become suspicious of the other party's propriety. Even a mechanic who can't handle the electronics in a new car will tell you there's too much English in your engine, as he advises you to seek a better-equipped garage. For the word to lose its pejorative connotation, the elite will have to conquer corruption in English. Our in-depth article, The Last Word, this week is titled, Bringing Guns to the Culture War. Armed paramilitary groups are taking to the streets to confront and threaten ideological opponents, said Joshua Partlow in the Washington Post. They're injecting a new kind of fear into American politics. Before his political awakening this spring, Peter Diaz lived a quiet life near Olympia, Washington, a leafy liberal bastion at the base of Puget Sound. He ran a tree trimming service and business that built office cubicles. He was 37 and had never voted. Now he has formed his own political party and is the leader of American Wolf, a roving band of civilians who have anointed themselves peacekeepers amid months of tense protest over racism and policing. In the name of law and order, members of his informal group have shot paintballs at demonstrators and carry zip ties and bear spray as they look for anti-fascists. Diaz has done recon in Minneapolis and in Seattle's autonomous zone, and drove his American Wolf mobile home to Mount Rushmore to celebrate Independence Day with President Donald Trump. America's summer of anxiety and rage has swept up men like Diaz, energizing conservatives who are deploying to the front lines of the culture war. Across the country, conservative armed civilians have surged into public view, marching on state houses, challenging Black Lives Matter protests, chasing internet rumors, and bringing the threat of lethal force to local politics. These groups often rally in defense of the president and see themselves as pro-government allies of local law enforcement. We're the silent majority, Diaz said, standing outside his house with a .45 caliber Remington handgun on his belt. It's time to act. Many members of these armed groups consider this pre-election period a defining moment. In the pandemic stay-at-home orders, they see government overreach that restricts their freedoms and harms their businesses. In the months of volatile street protests, they see local authorities who lost the nerve to confront violent agitators. The federal agents clashing with protesters in Oregon are our Portland heroes, Diaz wrote on Facebook last week. Not performing illegal arrests, as critics have alleged, but making strategic detentions of high-value targets. Diaz visited Portland earlier this month to offer federal agents free beer and homemade medals of valor as a show of his appreciation. Gun-toting civilians have stormed the Michigan Capitol, demanding the state lift coronavirus restrictions, and rushed to a battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, following a flag-burning hoax. After a member of a civilian militia in New Mexico shot and critically injured a man, a prosecutor in Albuquerque earlier this month sued the militia in an attempt to stop it from showing up as a military unit at protest and assuming law enforcement duties. With a hodgepodge of military garb and over-the-counter assault rifles, such self-styled patriots come from lots of backgrounds, but they are predominantly white and male. They're often veterans who say the mission now is to defend the Constitution and the freedoms they fought for in Iraq and Afghanistan. I never thought that I'd be in the back of a pickup rolling through downtown Olympia with six guys heavily locked and loaded, armored out, said Diaz, a former Army reservist. I'm doing something now that's for a greater cause than myself, and it really feels effing good. In the Pacific Northwest, far-right and militia-style groups have a long history, but the past standoffs and dramas tended to play out in remote rural settings. During the pandemic and protest, right-wing groups such as the Washington Three Percenters, Proud Boys, and Patriot Prayer have held rallies to declare their rights and appeared as counter-protesters at others' events. Supporters of these groups are running in state and local elections this year in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and elsewhere across the region. Their appearance at hundreds of events and protests this year across the country is part of their effort to normalize the presence of armed paramilitaries on the streets, which is a remarkably disturbing turn of events, said Devin Burghardt, president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, a Seattle-based organization that tracks far-right groups. What we're seeing right now is the outward manifestation of years of organizing by militia-type groups, Burghardt said. They've moved from backwoods training to on-the-streets activism. The display of guns in this tense political moment has not been confined to conservatives. A Black Lives Matter protester who was carrying an assault rifle was shot and killed in Austin. In the Northwest, leftist groups such as the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club also carried weapons as they escorted speakers or guarded Seattle's protest encampment in the Capitol Hill neighborhood. There were at least six people shot and two deaths in the vicinity of the encampment before it was eventually cleared by police earlier this month. We've had a few events where Proud Boys have gotten up in our faces and yelled and threatened us, said Nick, a member of the gun club who gave only his first name, referring to the self-proclaimed Western Chauvinist group that the Southern Poverty Law Center labels a hate group. They don't throw punches at us because they know we're armed. In the foothills of the Cascades, the leader of the Washington Three Percenters was building a lakeside bonfire for a 4th of July campaign fundraiser for a Republican state house candidate. Craig Hanvey, 45, doused the logs in gasoline and took aim with a blowtorch. The day's special kindling, a copy of John Lee Anderson's 800-page biography of Che Guevara, the Argentine revolutionary. It was no Marxist tract, but it pictured a Marxist on the cover. The book burst into flames. The socialist agenda needs to get reined in, Hanvey said. There is a performative provocateur's flavor to these groups. At the fundraiser, Hanvey was carrying a handgun and wearing a Hawaiian shirt. The sartorial symbol of the Boogaloo Boys, a fringe movement that anticipates a second American Civil War. But Hanvey said he has considered only that it was a warm summer day and the shirt had short sleeves. The Washington Three Percenters is an offshoot of a national organization whose name refers to a debunked estimate that only 3% of colonists fought in the American Revolution. The state group, which has 437 members, Hanvey said, appears in public with long guns and body armor. Such armed groups have been the target of criticism and, in some cases, ridicule. In June, comedian Sacha Baron Cohen turned up unannounced at a pro-gun rally in Olympia organized by far-right groups. Disguised in a long beard and overalls, he sang a song mocking the event. "Sleepy Joe Biden, what we gonna do? Inject him with the Wuhan flu," was one of his tamer lines. "Obviously, they're trying to prank us and make us look like a bunch of racists," said Matt Marshall, the founder and former leader of the Washington Three Percenters, who helped organize the rally. Video of the event was widely shared online and written up in entertainment publications. But the public embarrassment, some in the crowd sang along with Cohen, others booed, was a recruiting boon for the armed group. Marshall, a former Army medic who served in Afghanistan, was elected to Eatonville's school board last year. He said he finds the military attire counterproductive. "We're not winning anybody in the middle by showing up in body armor and military fatigues and AR-15s, he said. "Nobody's looking at this and going, oh, these look like the normal people I want to talk to." In speeches, Marshall has preached against racism and in favor of tolerance. He advocates civic duty and civil discourse. He bemoans how social media has helped people demonize their enemies, fostered cancel culture, and fomented division in the United States. But Marshall's critics see a darker reality beneath the rhetoric. Civil rights groups contend that the Washington Three Percenters is an anti-government militia that promotes conspiracy theories and seeks to undermine democratic institutions. Recent appearances by armed groups, particularly in liberal-leaning communities, have prompted local scandals. One night in early June, members of the Three Percenters showed up outside an Olympia gun store that had posted on Facebook a warning about riots planned for that night and invited armed citizenry to help secure the business. Members of the group later appeared in a photo from that night standing alongside an Olympia police officer. "It was a complete overuse of force and intimidation," said Sam Rasmussen, the owner of a restaurant next to the gun shop. "It is not good for a sleepy town to have armed gunmen in it." Joe Evans, a military veteran and libertarian candidate for Congress, was beaten over the head outside City Hall by three members of a motorcycle gang that descended on the Boise that day alongside hundreds of other armed white men. "They were there specifically to attack Black Lives Matter," Evans said. "It was obvious they supported white nationalism, white separatism, or white supremacy in some form." Evans said that he has attended several pro-Second Amendment events in the past and has no issues with weapons being present in public, but that the armed men who arrived that day were belligerent and dangerous. "I'm good for spirited debate," Evans said. "I love it. That's important. But what happened June 30th was unprecedented and extremely inappropriate for the way we normally do business here." One night in late June, Peter Diaz heard Black Lives Matter protesters were attempting to set up an autonomous zone in his hometown of Olympia, modeled on Seattle's Capitol Hill organized protest, CHOP or CHOP zone. He jumped in his truck. "It was just like, oh no, they're not," said Diaz. Diaz drove his truck through the caution tape that had been strung up, pulled out a knife, and began arguing with protesters, mostly teens and people in their 20s. He said, Amid the yelling, Diaz said he and other members of his group were prodded with umbrellas, and then he was maced in the face. The incident was captured on video. One of my guys stepped up and goes, bap, 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 and shot four paintballs directly into the group, he said. Diaz denies that he is a racist, saying he is the son of a Mexican immigrant. There are also black members of American Wolf. Diaz conceded that he was a little bit more aggressive than I needed to be, but said he was angry about being maced. He blames the recent riots in Portland and Seattle on people with a deep hatred for American ideals. Most of them haven't been able to make their way, so they hate the system we're in, he said. They want to have a government that gives them everything. They want socialism. Diaz insists he plays a positive role in the community, but his brand of belligerent civilian freelancing has alarmed authorities in Olympia, a predominantly white and liberal city. Dozens of local officials, including Democratic Olympia Mayor Cheryl Selby, signed an open letter last month condemning American Wolf and other militia-style groups as armed vigilantes who have created a climate of fear in the state capital. Selby's criticism of vigilante groups and her decision to kneel with Black Lives Matter protesters early in the movement has sparked an outpouring of hate mail. I've gotten serious threats from across the country from the alt-right, Selby says. Vicious, vicious things being called the worst names. The city has also suffered from a wave of vandalism by leftist anarchists, she said, who have made late-night vandalism runs into the city, breaking windows, setting dumpster fires, and tagging buildings with graffiti, including Selby's home. They're both inciting each other, Selby said. It's mostly in our situation the anarchist groups creating the havoc and chaos. But we still are very much wanting our community to know we don't need any help from our militia-type groups. Our police got this. They got this fine. Stay home. A version of this article appeared originally in the Washington Post. Read another obituary this week. The cowboy turned actor who starred in Cocoon. Wilford Brimley, 1934 to 2020. With Wilford Brimley, what you saw was really what you got. A burly, straight-talking former rodeo rider and stuntman with an impressive walrus mustache, the actor developed a niche in Hollywood playing folksy guys who had no time for nonsense. Brimley was a pugnacious assistant U.S. attorney in 1981's Absence of Malice, a world-weary baseball skipper in 1984's The Natural, and in one of the rare occasions he was cast against type, a sinister security chief in 1993's The Firm. Perhaps his most memorable big screen role was in the 1985 Ron Howard fantasy, Cocoon, playing a Florida retiree who regains his youth thanks to an alien intervention. On TV, he starred as the cantankerous but lovable grandpa Gus Witherspoon on the 1986-88 NBC series Our House. "I'm never the leading man," Brimley says, of his over in 1993, "I never get the girl, and I never get to take my shirt off." He was born in Salt Lake City to a real estate broker father who sold the family farm in 1939 and moved his family to Santa Monica, California, said the New York Times. Brimley dropped out of school at 14 to work as a cowboy before enlisting in the Marines. After leaving the Corps, he worked as a ranch hand, a bodyguard for Howard Hughes, and eventually a stuntman on TV and movie westerns. Brimley struck up a lifelong friendship with Robert Duvall on a set in 1967 and, impressed with the actor's craft, decided to shift from stunt work to acting. "It pays better," Brimley explained, "and you don't have to hit the ground." His Hollywood career took off after his appearance in 1979's The China Syndrome, said the Associated Press, playing a worker at a nuclear power plant that's plagued with safety violations. With an undisguised aversion to Hollywood, Brimley preferred to live on his properties in Santa Clara, Utah, and Grey Bull, Wyoming, said the Washington Post. He left occasionally to make a movie, sing with a jazz combo, or record a TV ad. Though Brimley dismissed his acting talent, he admitted he found great joy in performing. "It's the greatest hiding place I know," Brimley said. "I'm able to put those clothes on and use that name and those words and then tell the truth about myself." And we'll go right on over to the talking points page. We'll start with one titled UFOs, the Pentagon's Secret Study. "Are aliens real?" asked Matt Novak in Gizmodo.com. Believe it or not, the Pentagon has a shadowy unit that is still studying this question by examining a series of unexplained UFO sightings, the New York Times recently reported. In a story buried on page 17, the Times said earlier claims that the Pentagon had completed its study were not true. One former contractor, astrophysicist Eric Davis, said he briefed officials in March on retrievals from off-world vehicles not made on this Earth, suggesting the possibility of little green men might, in fact, be real. And all of this comes on the heels of the Pentagon declassifying in April three videos of Navy pilots encountering strange objects capable of flying at huge speeds, stopping on a dime, and banking at seemingly impossible angles. Many UFO enthusiasts understandably see these new developments as a sign that we are on the brink of full disclosure about visitors from outer space, said Greg Agigian in Slate.com. The Times reported that the Senate is requiring the Pentagon to release a public report on its UFO findings within 3 months. "But I think the believers are in for a big disappointment. The Pentagon group is focused on threats to national security rather than on spacecraft or possible alien visitors, and questions have been raised about Davis' legitimacy, honesty, and close ties to UFO crusaders." One of the Times story's authors, Ralph Blumenthal, has since backed away from the supposed extraterrestrial origin of recovered materials. "He didn't say aliens," Blumenthal said, "and neither do we." It's not unlikely, or it's not likely, that many unexplainable UFO sightings, including the ones recorded by Navy pilots, represent alien visitation, said Ravi Koparapu and Jacob Hock Misra in ScientificAmerican.com. "But this is a global phenomenon, and UFOs deserve a serious and transparent interdisciplinary scientific investigation, not just a questionable study by the Pentagon. In the past, mainstream scientists have shied away from the study of UFOs out of fear of being considered kooks. But we should all approach this topic with open minds." "If extraterrestrials really are visiting us," said Glenn Harlan Reynolds in USAtoday.com, "this year would be the perfect year to find out. After the pandemic, the murder hornets, and other bizarre events, humanity is finally psychologically ready to handle alien contact. In 2020, an alien invasion just feels right. Somehow." And we'll wind down with some shorter pieces, starting with, "Since a divorce settlement with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos last year left her the world's third richest woman, Mackenzie Scott has donated money at a furious pace, giving away $1.7 billion in a single year. The money went to 116 nonprofit organizations, working on issues including LGBTQ equality, climate change, and especially racial justice. Scott has pledged to keep at it until the safe is empty. A marine heat wave is afflicting the eastern seaboard and has led to unusual fish catches in New England. Species usually found in the Gulf Stream, including mahi-mahi and tarpon, are increasingly showing up on fishermen's lines in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, where waters are as much as 7 degrees warmer than normal. On the poll watch, 62% of Americans feel they can't freely speak what's on their minds in the current political climate out of fear of being deemed offensive, including 77% of Republicans. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who says, "Many people take no care of their money till they come nearly to the end of it, and others do just the same with their time." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.